From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. Our guest on this edition of the program is P.J. Crowley, author of a new book, Red Line, American Foreign Policy in a Time of Fractured Politics and Failing States. P.J. Crowley, who is no stranger to these VOA microphones, served as Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs and spokesman for the U.S. Department of State from 2009 to 2011 under Secretary Hillary Clinton. He is currently a professor of practice and distinguished fellow at the Institute for Public Diplomacy and Global Communication at the George Washington University here in Washington. Before joining the Obama administration, PJ was a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, that's a liberal think tank here in Washington. He focused on homeland security in the aftermath of the 9/11 terror attacks on U.S. soil. PJ is also a retired Air Force colonel and is a veteran of operations Desert Shield and Desert Storm in 1991. He also served on the National Security Council staff at the White House and as special assistant to former President Bill Clinton. And we are delighted now to welcome him again to the VOA microphones to discuss his new book, Red Line, in which he unpacks the legacy of American triumphs and failures in Iraq. Over the past quarter century, four consecutive American presidents, two Democratic and two Republican, have spent more time, diplomatic capital, and military resources on Iraq than any country in the world. P.J. Crowley argues that as much as the Vietnam Syndrome cast a long shadow over American security policy in the decades after the end of the Vietnam War, Iraq provides the commanding narrative for this generation of American leaders. In addition to discussing the themes in Red Line, we'll also discuss with PJ how he evaluates the Trump administration's evolving foreign policy and national security agenda, which some analysts fear may upend decades of building and sustaining the post-World War II liberal international order. And P.J. Crowley joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. P.J., welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And as always, delighted to welcome my colleague, Jeff Selden.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, P.J., we know you've been writing this book for quite some time, as well as we have a new administration. So talk about why you wrote the book and how it's relevant today.
You know, over 30 years, Carol, I heard a number of times policymakers say that politics should stop at the water's edge. It never has, and it never will. But today, to understand American foreign policy, you have to understand American domestic politics. And this is not necessarily unique to the United States. Obviously, we've seen in recent months a dramatic change in British foreign policy, you know, based on the referendum where the British voters, by a decisive but narrow margin, said that the United Kingdom should leave the European Union.
Following up on what you just said, and of course, we have to refer to the title, Red Line. We know that's the famous statement that President Obama made in August of 2013, in which he said if Bashar al-Assad used chemical weapons, then he would be crossing a red line and the United States would have to act. But in fact, the United States didn't act in a military sense, in even a limited military sense, notwithstanding the chemical weapons deal that the United States struck with Russia. Some analysts say this could be a big mistake and that this was perhaps regrettable, that by not enforcing the red line, the United States signaled weakness to our allies. People in Asia states were concerned that this would show weakness and maybe encourage China in the South China Sea. Vladimir Putin, a year later, invaded Ukraine, took Crimea. Talk about your interpretation of this red line.
There's a lot to unpack there. You know, certainly I think that Obama, you know, his mandate coming into office in 2009 was to unwind the American wars that he inherited and to avoid a new one. And whether you think it was right or wrong, you know, he largely delivered the foreign policy that he advertised during the 2008 campaign. I do think that he mismanaged the red line when he was at the podium at the White House in August of 2013. You know, he confronted the same challenge that had been elucidated by Caspar Weinberger, the Secretary of Defense during the Reagan administration. Cap Weinberger and his Weinberger Doctrine, later reinforced by Colin Powell, said you don't go to war without reasonable assurance of public support and congressional support. And at the end of the day, Obama realized that as he threatened military force against Syria, yeah, he didn't have the American people behind him, and he didn't have the Congress behind him either.
Just a quick caveat in terms of war. Of course, he could have struck. This was not really a declaration of war, nor were boots on the ground anticipated. And I do recall that the Syrian opposition, the rebel opposition, did not want any boots on the ground whatsoever. Nonetheless, it's a fair point.
I mean, I certainly believe that when a president goes to the podium and says, we are going to take military action, he has to follow through with that, and Obama didn't. By the same token, what we saw later was that Obama tried to thread a delicate needle by focusing on the Islamic State in Syria. So he defined the American interest in Syria as defeating the Islamic State, not trying to impose a solution on the broader Syrian civil war. In fact, I would argue that given the politics of the 2016 campaign, the rhetoric will be different. Perhaps there'll be the opportunity for greater cooperation with Russia. I doubt that's going to be successful. But the same political dynamic that impacted foreign policy under President Obama, that same political dynamic was manifest in the 2016 campaign and will influence the Trump administration and its evolving strategy regarding Syria as well.
Indeed. And of course, this is the great irony. In 2013, President Obama interpreted his red line as perhaps going to war against the wishes of the American people. But in fact, later on, to combat the Islamic State, he sent so many more thousands of troops to that region to combat ISIS without consulting Congress.
I mean, President Obama took a lot of criticism, you know, for withdrawing U.S. forces from Iraq in 2011. Although clearly, if you go back to the 2008 campaign, that was the most significant mandate he brought into office. But here, politics works both ways. What people who criticized the Obama decision in 2011 fail to recognize is the impact of Iraqi politics. No question that a sovereign Iraq, the Iraqi people in 2011, desperately wanted American forces to leave. And so the politics both in the United States and the politics in Iraq prevented, you know, the placement of a follow-on force. Now, fast forward to 2014, when President Obama did reintroduce U.S. forces into Iraq. Since then, we've seen a reinforcement of political legitimacy, that the Iraqi people, by and large, have welcomed or do not question the role of U.S. forces together as part of a broader coalition to defeat the Islamic State. That's going to happen in Iraq sooner. It's going to happen in Syria later. But you have a much different political dynamic in the region today than we saw between 2003 and 2011.
Indeed, and all of this underscores your theme, which is the intersection between foreign policy and domestic politics. Well, let me turn to my colleague, Jeff Selden, for a question or two.
It's interesting when you talk about the local politics, and then we talk about how that affects U.S. foreign policy, how it's affecting British foreign policy. And when you look at the situation as it was developing in Iraq, going back even to before the Obama administration, did the U.S. have a hard time really gauging what was going on the local level that at one point would have the Iraqis actually advocating for the U.S. to leave for a non-U.S. presence, only to create a situation where later the U.S. was welcomed back because it was so desperately needed? While it's important to realize what U.S. domestic policy does the U.S. have a problem understanding how domestic policy is playing out in areas where it perhaps is getting involved or is thinking about getting involved that sets it up for bigger problems down the road?
Well, at the State Department, diplomats focus a great deal on the politics of other countries to understand the dynamic and then the impact that U.S. policy may or may not have in that country or that region. Although I think that if you think about the investment of the United States in the Middle East peace process, for example, even today, you would argue that the challenge of reaching a final status agreement between the Israelis and Palestinians is less a matter of substance than it is a matter of politics, that you have zero-sum calculations both from the Israeli perspective and the Palestinian perspective, that have not prevented leaders from making the difficult concessions that are necessary to achieve that agreement. So, during the Obama administration, there was a very significant effort under, first Hillary Clinton, in particular under John Kerry, to try to achieve a breakthrough in terms of the Middle East peace process. And yet, when you step back and look at it in retrospect, the reality is the politics there just didn't allow that the kind of breakthrough that the United States sought. So I think that this is part of the challenge in terms of how we as the United States, we see our role in the world. And yes, we remain the most influential country in the world. But by the same token, I think what we saw during the Obama administration was a greater recognition of the limits of American power as well. We are an exceptional nation, but we're not necessarily indispensable in the sense that in today's environment, no one is going to supplant the United States in terms of overall influence and power. But there are a lot of states, rising powers such as China, Russia, Turkey, or non-state actors, including the Islamic State, that have the ability to frustrate the promulgation of U.S. foreign policy.
It's always easy to look back and say something could have been done differently. And as the situation in Syria, during Obama's presidency, began to worsen, there were a lot of analysts, a lot of scholars who were saying, no matter what option you take, there may not be a good solution. Given that it hasn't gone well so far, and it's really allowed Russia to manipulate the situation to reemerge on the global stage, looking back, is there anything President Obama could have done differently that maybe, in hindsight, would have been wiser, would have resulted in a slightly better outcome?
I'm not sure. I do think that there was a misreading in 2011 based on what had happened in Tunisia, based on what had happened in Egypt, when you did see the beginnings of peaceful protests that turned violent in Syria. The Obama administration, looking at the overall dynamic in what was then called the Arab Spring, believed that Bashar al-Assad's days were numbered. In fact, after the intervention in Libya, the president in August of 2011 said that Bashar al-Assad has lost his legitimacy and needs to step aside. I think in retrospect, the Obama administration underestimated how forceful the Assad regime, later supported by Iran and Russia, how hard they would fight to hold on to power.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is P.J. Crowley, the author of the recently published book, Red Line, American Foreign Policy in a Time of Fractured Politics and Failing States. P.J. is also former Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs, currently professor and distinguished fellow at the Institute for Public Diplomacy and Global Communication at the George Washington University. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or connect with us on Facebook. And here's a shout-out to a valued female listener, Adiolu Osunkoya Samson from Lagos, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please give us some feedback on this show by sending an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, P.J. Crowley. Well, P.J., now that we have the Trump administration in place, it would be very interesting to get your insights, any guidance that you have for the new administration, especially given the themes we've heard so far, America first, looking more inward. Are we in retreat? At least on the world stage, talk about the implications of what we've heard so far.
Well, I didn't write the book necessarily with Donald Trump in mind, but his campaign, his election, and now his inauguration certainly reinforce the central premise of the book, that there is this very significant interplay among American foreign policy, domestic politics, and the political narratives that animate American foreign policy. And certainly, as we evaluate the inauguration and Donald Trump's first week in office, his inaugural address was very unusual. It could well have been a direct extension from his campaign rhetoric. And many of the early actions demonstrate, we can argue as we go down the road, whether this is a good policy for the United States and the world or not. But he certainly has taken concrete steps in foreign policy to follow through on the promises that he made on the campaign trail and for which he believes he was elected by a plurality, if not a majority, of the American voters.
Now, even though President Obama was also more modest or careful, always saying that the United States is exceptional, it's a unique country on the world stage, he did, as you indicated and said in the book, that we have limits to our power. But now Mr. Trump seems to be really taking this to another level, what was derisively characterized as leading from behind under President Obama. We're really sort of taking this to a different level. Will the world now look to Moscow or Beijing for leadership? How do you see the implications?
Well, I don't think that what we see in the United States is necessarily unique. Mr. Trump, in his inauguration, said that the United States will put its own interests first, and he's challenged other countries to do the same. I think that his election and one of his earliest steps to formally withdraw from the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, reflects a very significant skepticism that we've seen rise in the United States. It certainly is prevalent in Europe as well, in terms of the impact of globalization and the reality that while globalization has been broadly beneficial for the country, we have left behind a significant percentage of the population that feels they've been the losers, you know, without necessarily commensurate actions to compensate. And so here we are in the current situation where you do see that Mr. Trump is following through on some of his anti-trade rhetoric, and now you're left with President Xi Jinping of China, who's become the great defender of globalization. We'll see where that goes.
Irony of ironies. I need to ask you one more quick question, because the withdrawal from the TPP probably riles the Republican Congress more than pleases it. So I want you to try to help us understand and reconcile some discrepancies, for example, on these stances that he's taking. And with respect to Mr. Trump's cabinet, many of them are more mainstream Republicans, whether it's the new CIA director, Mike Pompeo, or Rex Tillerson, who is set to be Secretary of State. The question is, whose positions will prevail? Because many of them would disagree with some of his platforms.
Well, I mean, the reality is that TPP was not going to be ratified by the United States Senate, perhaps more so because of Democratic skepticism than Republican skepticism. And of course, he will meet in the coming days with the President of Mexico and the Prime Minister of Canada with the idea of renegotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement. Now, a trade agreement that's 20 years old certainly can be updated, but I think this will be the first area where not only President Trump and his America First political dynamic confronts other countries. They want to pursue common interests, but they want to make sure that their countries benefit from these steps as well. So I think trade is an area where probably there can be a pivot. You know, Mr. Trump said on the campaign trail that we've been victimized by bad trade deals, and he'll have the ability to renegotiate, update things, and then say, well, these are better.
Indeed. Well, let's make a very important distinction between international trade, the value thereof, and trade deals. I think the American public is in favor of trade, but some agreements, such as NAFTA, may need to be tweaked. So there is a distinction to be made, and there's certainly improvements to be made in that arena.
A lot of the rhetoric during the campaign from President Trump focused not just on the trade deals and on bad trade deals, but also on some of the traditional alliances that the United States had had, including the NATO alliance, which has been a bedrock of the United States and its European allies for so many years now. Is there a danger, though, now with President Trump in the White House, of the rhetoric getting mixed, almost mixed messages going out? Because he hasn't changed his opinions on those alliances, but yet his pick for defense secretary, James Mattis, who's now at the Pentagon, his first conversations have been sending a very strong message, it would seem, about the importance of those alliances, reaching out on his first full day to Britain, to Canada, to the NATO Secretary General. And then his second day, he reached out to Australia and New Zealand, part of the ANZAC alliance. So it seems like from the White House, you get one message. From the Pentagon, you have another. What types of problems does this create if different parts of the government seem to be moving forward with their almost own foreign policies?
I think there were two dimensions, you know, to his criticism of America's alliances. You know, one was that key allies needed to do more to pull their own weight. You know, that actually has been something, particularly in the context of NATO, that American secretaries of defense and secretaries of state have said repeatedly as they've seen defense budgets decline among their key allies. That's something that I think represents a certain continuity. When he called NATO obsolete, I think he was in error there. And now Secretary of Defense James Mattis said in his confirmation hearing, if NATO didn't exist, we'd have to invent it. And I also think that Mr. Trump was in error when he was talking about nonproliferation, where he said he was agnostic as to whether Japan and South Korea pursued their own nuclear programs. He's kind of walked that back. You know, so I think that's an area where I just think that much of what he said on the campaign trail was based on instinct, not rooted in experience. Those are things I think will evolve as the Trump administration gets settled.
How difficult is it, though, for even U.S. allies like Japan, like Korea, like Britain, like France, to understand how to react to all of this when you have the president, whether reacting from pure instinct or lack of experience, saying one thing, you have choices for key departments like the Pentagon, like State Department, indicate another. Who do they believe? How do they react? Even when the president's own advisors say, look in his heart, not at what he says.
And that gets to my question to you, PJ, just to elaborate more. The varying power centers, we have cabinet-level officials who are approved by Congress, but you have the White House advisors who are not, and you have a national security advisor, General Mike Flynn, who may be at odds with the Secretary of Defense. So again, to the question of, you know, who prevails and what does this say to the world? How are they to react? And we haven't even mentioned the tweets yet.
I was going to bring that up. Yeah, I mean, every new American administration faces a learning curve. You know, the reality of the world is different than the campaign rhetoric, you know, would suggest. I do think quite candidly that the learning curve for the Trump administration is going to be steeper. Again, part of the political context of the campaign that has carried over into the early days of the Trump administration is this breach between the Trump team and the Republican national security establishment, you know, many of whom refused to support Mr. Trump as a candidate for president, and that hatchet has not been buried. And so I think there are legitimate questions. Each of the key cabinet officials within the national security team has experience. The roles they're being asked to play are somewhat different than what they've done in the past. James Mattis was a senior military commander. Now he's the Secretary of Defense. General Flynn was an intelligence tactician. Now he's leading the strategic development of U.S. policy. Will they grow into those roles? Of course they will. How will they be challenged while that process is going on? That is crucial. I think what you are seeing, President Trump, is a very interesting and quite unusual dynamic. You know, he's carried the same dynamic of the campaign into the White House. He's now tweeting a lot. He's obviously paying attention to what is being reported about him. I don't think he quite understands yet how to make that shift from being the outside political operator to being president. The first week was a tough one for the Trump White House. You know, the emergence of these issues that are diversions from the policy focus that they need to have. We now have a new term of art within the Trump administration, alternative facts. And so this is a very unusual dynamic, but I think that it just reflects the fascinating politics that we see here in the United States. Those politics are certainly something we see around the world. And quite honestly, it's becoming much more difficult to govern in this environment.
Another unusual dynamic, PJ Crowley, is this friendliness to Vladimir Putin that Mr. Trump showed during the campaign and seems to show now that he's in office, this cozying up to Putin. Look, nobody's disagreeing that it would be best to have more friendly relations with Russia. It's an important country on the world stage. We have many common interests. But it is a known fact that Mr. Putin is an autocrat. Elections are not free. He does terrorize. He even kills political opponents and journalists. He flouts international law, as we saw the invasion of a sovereign country, the annexation of Crimea. Are we witnessing, do you think, the beginning of an upending of the post-World War II and Cold War order under Mr. Trump?
I don't know. I certainly think that the current politics within the United States, I think we still have an internationalist foreign policy. I'm not sure to what degree we have an interventionist foreign policy. And that change of dynamic occurred under President Obama. Regarding Russia, I mean, we've seen this dynamic. President Bush came into office with high hopes of a reasonable working relationship with Vladimir Putin and left office just following the Russian incursion into Georgia. You know, the Obama administration attempted to reset relations under President Dmitry Medvedev and had some successes there, but obviously disillusioned by the Russian intervention in Ukraine and Syria. And here I think President Trump is at odds to a large degree with his cabinet that carries into office deep skepticism about the ability of the United States and Russia to cooperate. There are not shared interests when it comes to Syria, certainly not when it comes to European, you know, stability. And there's also deep odds between Mr. Trump and members of his own party in Congress in both houses that are very likely, given the clear Russian interference in the 2016 American election, there are going to be a new round of sanctions against Russia. I think this is where ultimately, you know, I understand Mr. Trump's instincts as a deal maker, but he's going to find the prospects of a meaningful cooperation between the United States and Russia to be very, very limited.
One of the things that's been interesting about President Trump is the way that he tweets. And one of the questions I want to ask is there an advantage to this? Is there an advantage to the fact that he's saying, as president, things that are unorthodox by American presidential standards in terms of foreign policy? Does it give him an edge in terms of making some of these deals? Because everybody else now is off balance, not sure what to expect. Is there perhaps some sort of brilliance or genius to this strategy, even though for a lot of the foreign policy establishment, it probably seems very unnerving?
Well, I think we have to differentiate between the channel of communication and the substance of that communication. Twitter, Facebook, other means of social media, they're now real channels of communication to meaningful pockets of people throughout the world. It doesn't take away from television and radio as being important. You know, it's just another means of reaching beyond governments to be able to communicate with publics around the world. Governments should exploit these opportunities. Now, when you talk about what is actually the content of those messages, that is the challenge. I think he's shown the potential power of these tweets. By the same token, I think the risk for President Trump is that, just because of what you said, Jeff, that, okay, when a president of the United States speaks, the world does listen. But if it turns out that what he says is just the posturing of the first round of a negotiation, then eventually the risk is that the word of the President of the United States becomes discounted. He becomes less credible. And that does have impact in terms of how other countries, how other leaders, how other populations will view American foreign policy going forward.
And I'd like to remind our listeners that social media, whether it's Facebook or Twitter, they're platforms. So you can even listen to our radio programs on Twitter and on Facebook, because we do post them there. My last question to you, PJ Crowley, to circle back to the theme of your book, which is that Iraq provides the commanding narrative for this generation of American leaders, including Mr. Trump. So he has said that he will destroy ISIS. That is a very important goal of this administration. And it's important for America. It's important for the world. How do you think he's going to accomplish it? Can he do it just by saying so and then using military force? What other parts of the policy will have to be brought to bear? He talks about collaborating with Russia, but we've seen Russia on the ground is not a very good partner. They're more concerned about even the rebel opposition in Syria more than really combating ISIS. How do you think he can accomplish this?
So the United States will continue to work with the coalition to try to defeat the Islamic State militarily, but the United States is not going to act militarily to impose a solution on the broader Syrian civil war. That will be something that will be done politically. And I think, unfortunately, the reality on the ground in Syria does not yet lend itself to a political negotiation. But I think we're still some time away from where the situation on the ground will stabilize sufficiently that enables a political solution. But I think on this score, the Trump administration will probably significantly mirror in policy, if not in rhetoric, the existing policy of the Obama administration with respect to defeating the Islamic State.
The book is Red Line, American Foreign Policy in a Time of Fractured Politics and Failing States. The author, P.J. Crowley, retired Air Force colonel and former Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs. As always, P.J., thank you for your wonderful insights and congratulations once again on your book.
Thank you very, very much.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced here in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Audrius Rigas. And joining me on the program was VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.